lost everything. Until that dog arrived on my doorstep. A final gift for my wife. In that moment, I received some semblance of hope. An opportunity to grieve on alone. And your son took that from me.
Hakon stole that from me. Killed that from me! People keep asking if I'm back, and I haven't really had an answer. But now, yeah, I'm thinking I'm back.
Welcome to the 3 Men in a Retrospective podcast. Look at the entire John Wick franchise.
Bonjour, Monsieur Wick, and welcome to La Resistance.
Join Garrett.
Well, your little act of uncivil disobedience inspired me, John. I'm branching out, spreading my wings.
Matt.
You working again?
No, just sorting some stuff out.
And Adam.
This life follows you.
As they earn their coins by reviewing each film of the Keanu Reeves starring franchise, leading up to a review of Ballerina, released by Lionsgate Films earlier this year.
30 paces. In the event that both parties survive, each will approach the other at increments of 10 paces until only one remains.
So unholster your ears in these confines, percolated media listeners.
I'm not asking you to kill anyone.
The Percolated Media John Wick Retrospective begins now.
If you would be so kind as to follow me.
John Wick, Chapter 2. Released February 10th, 2017, budget was $40 million, box office $174.3 million, and this is directed by Chad Stahelski. All right, well, as what happens with most of these that we talk about, this was planned as a one-off. There were no plans whatsoever. They just wanted to get that thing off the ground. They get it off the ground. It makes almost $100 million. Matt, it's inevitable. It's time for a sequel, right?
It's a bit of a surprise because the first one, with a movie like that and a star that, for all intents and purposes, was on life support, far exceeded expectations. But just because you can make a sequel doesn't mean you should. But I will give them credit that this is unlike a lot of, especially in the aughts or the noughties, depending on how you want to define the time period. It was rare to get like original franchises to have. Original movies to have sequels. You know, this is not based on anything outside of a spec script from many moons ago. Unlike, let's see, Marvel, DC, Jurassic Park, like everything that was happening around this time were franchises. And the old guard were basically done. Your Rambos, your Die Hards, those that had movies within about a decade or so, but there weren't going to be any more. And of course, Lethal Weapon had been all but obliterated in the near 30 years since the last one. So it was a calculated risk, but like I said on the last show, it was a welcome one because I was dying to go see it.
All right. The movie's out for a set of months. Matt and I caught up to it. Adam, you eventually caught up to it. You get word that there's chapter two. I mean, after the end of that last one and the success it had, it's pretty inevitable, isn't it?
Yeah, I think the way that it seemed to grow and grow. I mean, the box office wasn't huge when you think about it. I mean, it did its job, but I think this thing just kept spreading on word of mouth. I think this is one of the last holdovers for home media growing an audience. And I think this just kept bringing in people that eventually was like, you know what? We got a chance to make a lot more money if we do this again.
So the two directors, Stahelski and Leach, they announced that there was going to be a sequel. The writer, Derek Kolstad from last week, the one who, as Matt mentioned, made a spec script that eventually turned into what we got last week. He was back on board. He was writing the script. And then a little ways into pre-production, Chad Stahelski was all set and David Leach was nowhere to be found. The reason being, David Leitch started getting more opportunities, and a script had been laying on his desk called Atomic Blonde that he had been looking at for a while. He wanted to do it. So he goes on, he does Hobbs and Shaw, and he does Deadpool 2. He saw other opportunities, so David Leitch jumped off the project. Matt, you hear that Chad Stahelski's solo on this instead of the duo directors. Were you worried?
Not immediately, because there was only one credited director on the first one, I believe. I wasn't overly worried. It wasn't giving me cause or pause for concern at all.
Adam, had you heard that there was a pretty bitter divorce between these two? So we're going solo with this one.
I knew it just because I knew that Leech had left to go take over the Deadpool franchise after Deadpool became a $1 billion hit, and then that director decides to fuck off after making a $1 billion movie.
Yeah, he decided to go fuck up the Terminator franchise instead.
That corpse was already raped and left for dead in a ditch. All he did was just piss on the ashes.
You know what? He has done some of the best stuff he's done that I've enjoyed years, though, with Love, Death, Robots, and now Secret Levels. So I will give Tim Miller an opportunity to do anything. But I wasn't really worried. I felt like this is something simplistic, and I felt that between the two directors last time, doing two for a sequel, I think would be problematic. It makes sense when you're starting it out, you did it together, and you're building that world. But after that, look at Matrix sequels to see how stuff goes when you got competing interests.
Ooh, we'll get to those eventually, but that was, I believe, that was totally collaborative, and both those directors had their vision fulfilled, but maybe we'll get to those eventually.
Well, until you got to the fourth one, where it was just, I think, Lana Wachowski was the only one.
Yep.
Who...
Yeah, I was talking about the two Matrix sequels. All right.
Wait, there were Matrix sequels?
We open up with some rain-soaked streets and a motorcycle sliding into view with this video screen on a building. Right away, we know we have more money.
Yeah, but not drastically different. It's not like they did what so many other franchises do and just overinflate the budget by comparison. I mean, it is a big upgrade. They have more money to spend, but it wasn't an unnecessary slapping $150 million on it just because you could.
So we see a chase with a motorcycle and Wick's car. The bike crashes into Wick's car. He gets out and grabs a card from the driver's pocket before driving away. We're hearing Russian being spoken as some money is pulled on a wagon, and Peter Stormare, he puts a cigar in his mouth and lights it. There are a lot of that guys in this.
Huge. And right off the bat, I mean, this movie comes in hot. You know, we got a very minimal opening credit, which I appreciate, and this movie just goes. And we see some bad guys. We're starting with that. We got a brooch. We got a card. And then we get Uncle Stormare showing up here, Lucifer himself, and I don't know how you were going to top, you know, some of the people we got last week, but starting off with Stormare is a great way to do it. That character is, oh, goddamn, it's fun.
Yeah, it looks like he jumped right off the Armageddon set and jumped here because he's playing pretty much the same accent. Matt, a lot of that guys, right?
Well, I was thinking, was it Bad Boys? I think Bad Boys 2, he's the villain.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I was thinking of that. I also like that this opening is very Bond-esque. In a lot of ways, I think this series, kind of like Mission Impossible, mirrors Bond in a lot of ways, especially with how you don't see Wick for the first like 5 minutes. You don't get a close-up or a headshot or anything. They shoot him from the legs up. Speaking of Michael Bay, when he gets out of the car and takes the card out of the guy's pocket, they're almost setting it up like it's a new actor taking on the mantle. That's kind of how like Bond would do it. I mean, Dalton being the prime example. I like this a lot. It's also in a lot of ways, this opening is just the epilogue, the epitaph of the previous movie. But I think that reinforces the title of Chapter 2. Instead of calling it John Wick 2, because oftentimes sequels, when they slap a 2, there's more often than not a considerable amount of time. Chapter makes me look at this whole series as one book, so to speak, especially because this one is picking up right as the first one ended. So I think the title is actually appropriately placed in an era where I bitch about subtitles.
I do like that as well. I do like the fact that we are in a graphic novel at this point, and that is a nice feel. I'll agree with that. And this is just a complete attachment to the last week's film. And I didn't even realize it. You know, as I'm watching this, I'm like, okay, well, Wick's on another adventure. No, he's just going back to get his car. Although in watching this, you know, we're hearing that Stormare's playing Yosef's uncle, Abram. I'm like, oh, he's going to be the villain throughout the entire film. No, he's just here for like 10 minutes and he's gone.
And it's an interesting choice. Like, does this movie stand alone? Yeah, except for kind of this opening. Like, it would stand alone. And to Matt's point, it's almost, if you treat it like a Bond pre-title sequence, that's all it could be. By tying it into the one before, the chapter subtitle really makes sense. And it's fucking brilliant, especially if you're going to watch these in quick succession. You can enjoy yourself doing it because it's, you know, you put these two together. All right, you got a 3.5-hour movie. Well, stay tuned in 2 weeks. Like, you could absolutely do that.
Yeah, you're going to have a solo 3.5-hour movie in a couple weeks. So, Abrams saying how Yosef stole John Wick's car, which gets the same response as last week. He says that Wick's not stopping now, as he is a man of focus, commitment, and sheer fucking will. The other guy in the room, he doesn't want to hear the story about the pencil again, as Abrams warns all the worst Wick stories that you hear, they have been watered down. So, as bad as they are, they're actually worse in real life.
Love that. That line alone just lets you know that what we heard last week, which was so awesome, they set themselves up with just that line to bring us something spectacular in this ballet of violence.
Wick calls and says that you have my car, and after Wick hangs up, we just see the guy say, the boogeyman. Wick gets in his car, checks behind him, and turns it on. He pulls out of the lot, taking out some goons as he's still being chased. And we have some car foo here, and so we're going to get more car action here, aren't we, Matt?
Yes, and I'm not going to say that I was disappointed, but this felt more like conventional action, because what I like so much about the first one was the stunt work, the gun foo, and the more, you know, Sambo type of fighting style. This one, this opening, when it's just the car, like a car demolition derby. Apparently he doesn't love his car that much, because he beats that thing into oblivion willingly. Like, he's not even trying to avoid people for most of it. In fact, I think that he uses that car more than he uses his sidearm for most of this movie. But I can see car chases and this kind of stuff in a lot of other action movies. So I felt like I was getting something not watered down, but it's not what I want from this series.
I actually dug this quite a bit. Every time that you think it's going to end, it keeps going, you know, and it's a new level. I find it very video gamey, but in a good way here. So yeah, I'm on board and I say, yeah, come on, get on with it, move on. No, I am so engaged right off the bat, it's crazy.
So Wick takes out a few cars and then rams a motorcycle. And one thing I notice about these movies too, and it's obviously a strength given, as we mentioned last week, Keanu doesn't have the highest acting range. These movies are very light on dialogue. It was tough to pull clips just for the intro and outro of the series, given we have like 5 films, because there's not much dialogue, is there, Matt?
No. But I think that is one of the, in a lot of ways, it's the strength, because we've talked a lot about certain action films that are overly talkative. I mean, we talked about this with Final Reckoning, among other things, where this one, I also think because this has in this one particular and here on out, they're much more global. I think the fact that you don't have to conscientiously direct for foreign audience as far as translations and stuff makes it easier and doesn't feel like a necessity, because this is a character, much like the scripts, that is defined by what he does not say, because at one point he literally calls him like a man of few words. So I like that the filmmaking is kind of reflecting that, because look, these plots they're very straightforward, despite how almost intertangled like webs they seem to be. The dialogue doesn't feel like it has to explain what's going on. So I don't view that as a problem per se, and it also plays to the strengths of your star.
Agreed. Yeah, no, I very much think so. I think that you listen to every word that he says, because there's so few, and most of them are one word answers or one word sentences that he puts out. You know, I've long thought that, you know, I would love to see a movie that's nothing but score, sound, Foley work, and all that, and I don't need dialogue. This is about as close as you get to it. You know, I personally have been watching a lot of old Japanese samurai films and things like Kurosawa, Snowblood, things like that lately, and I use original audio and subtitles. Partway through, I stop looking at the subtitles, and I don't need it, and I think that this is kind of in that vein, and for somebody like Keanu Reeves, who loves that era of film, I think it's intentional.
So Wick rams another car as a body tumbles on his window, and then Wick just spins right into him. You know, Matt, you mentioned last week, it was practical for the most part, and here they have more money to play with, and this body being rammed, this is pretty bad CGI. I've seen this guy fly through the air. This is Count Dooku shit to me.
Well, he looks like he's made of paper, because he almost like floats through the air, but it's made up for the fact that he opens the car door just so the guy can flip and wipe out.
We're seeing some hand-to-hand combat as Wick is attacked by a taxi, and of course Wick is wearing all black. Wick shoots the guy, and we're seeing the carnage he created. So Wick then goes to visit Abram and pours himself a drink. He calls for peace, and they cheers to it as Abram tells him to enjoy his retirement. And that, boys, is our pre-title sequence.
In a lot of ways, you could stamp this and paste it at the end of the first movie, and it would still function.
So good. I love that at the end of it all, you don't know what's going to happen. He's just, Wick is pretty much closed the chapter on one, to Matt's point, because he wants peace. It's done. It's over.
Yeah, he's like, I got my revenge. I had my fill. And even though I don't know what I'm going to do next, it's not going to be this.
We cut to John pulling onto the street as he's opening some letters and pictures from his dead wife. And so we're still keeping this going. He's still keeping his wife in his mind.
Yeah, because Bridget Monahan needs a check. But also, it infers why he loved that car so much. He purposefully kept those in the glove compartment.
Mm-hmm. Good call. It's more than just material. So his dog walks up and Wick feeds him as we're seeing more flashes to his former life with his wife. He wakes up and Aurelio pulls up and Aurelio says that he thought John loved his car. And I do love this line. I don't know if you noticed, John, but you have a crack in your windshield. He says that he can have it ready by Christmas 2030. This is good stuff.
This is fun. I mean, you could tell that Leguizamo showed up for like 2 hours in the middle of the day. Because this is it. Like, he comes in, says a line, you know, and he's out. We don't see him again. But this is fun continuity. This is keeps that world that we loved, you know, that was built on last week. And it lets us know we're still in it. It breaks the tension after that opening amazing scene. I dig this a lot.
Especially because this one does not have as much comedic relief as the first one does. I mean, there's stuff to find, but it's sprinkled much more throughout in a sparing way compared to the first one. So I like that it's here to kind of, to Adam's point, ease the tension.
We see Wick go in the basement and cover the wreckage that he made last week as the doorbell rings. It's Santino, another guy that Wick knows, and Wick offers him some coffee. They make pleasantries as Wick says that he hasn't named his dog yet. I like this. This is a running gag throughout the movie. It's like everybody asks him, so what's your dog's name? I haven't named him yet.
Which also makes sense because he has not had the time.
Exactly. Santino says that he doesn't want to be there. He says that no one gets out and comes back without repercussions as he places a coin on the table. He says this is because of him. And then he says that for a man to take a marker and grant it to another, he has bind his soul to a blood oath. Santino points out the blood on the marker and says that he helped John, and if he doesn't do this, you know the consequences. John says he can't help him and moves the marker to the other side of the table. He apologizes and stands up. Santino then leaves, saying that he'll see him soon and that he has a beautiful home. Some good stuff here. Nice tension being built, along with some nice setup, because we know once Santino says he has a beautiful home, that's going to be blown up before long, and that's exactly what happens here pretty quick. How do we feel about this scene with Santino?
Everything about this is set up and paced beautifully. The second he is done smoothing out the concrete from reburying his past, as soon as he finishes and he kind of leans back a little bit, the doorbell rings. Like, as soon as he put it away. And then the realization that the reason that Santino is here, or I'm going to keep butchering.
The problem is the character is named Santino D'Antonio.
Yeah.
That's it.
So it's a double O.
So him, like, he shows up and he's like, look, I'm here because you came back. And then he's like, I have this marker because of you. Like, this is, as Winston mentioned last time, you know, what keeps us from the animals is the rules. And this is part of that. What happens to John's house is John's fault. He had this marker and now he's trying not to honor it. You know, right or wrong, at this point of the movie, Wick is breaking the rules. If this is a horror movie, if this is a slasher film, you broke the rules. You stepped across the salt.
So this is also a good bit of both world building and adding further context to the first movie, because this is directly connected to the impossible task that they mentioned in the first one. And I also like that it's the unfortunate reality. No one ever truly gets out. No matter how much you try, it will always, this part of your life will just permeate and return no matter how hard you try. And it's sort of these movies, the first one has some stuff about religion, certainly with purgatory. I like that this one, this is basically literally making a deal with the devil. And you're bound by blood to consummate the ritual, which is punishable by death if you refuse, as they allude to. So I like a lot of the setup, and this movie definitely has a whole lot of religious allegory in it, but it establishes the theme of the movie too, in that John is openly defiant but at the same time, you're on his side, and everything he does is reactionary without him coming across as a moron.
Although, is this Lethal Weapon 2 again? Because here we have yet another house being blown up in an action film.
It's like Iron Man 3. Yes. How do we get the hero? We're just going to, Batman Begins, we're just going to destroy his house.
Yeah. And at first I'm thinking, oh God, did they kill his dog? Because we don't see his dog after the house blows up. But here he comes walking up to John's side as he wakes up. So we're like, thank God he didn't kill this dog. They watch the house burn together. So we see Jimmy from the first film. He shows up to ask if this was a gas leak and if John's working again. The conversations between these two always cracks me up.
I like how they bring this back as a running gag.
Yeah. So how far is the Continental from John's house? Because we see him walking with his dog and they show up to the Continental. I would think this would be a kind of a far, far away walk.
He's in good shape.
Yeah, that's true.
Pit bulls are known for their endurance.
He's greeted by Sharon, who says it's good to see him again, and then points him in the direction of Winston. Wick tells Winston that they burned his house down and says that he gave his marker to Santino because he felt it was his only way out. Winston says the two Continental rules are no blood on the Continental grounds and that every marker needs to be honored. He says that without rules, they live with the animals.
So I also like that there's the continuity at the Continental. Mm-hmm. But the people he's meeting with have those cigar boxes that Peter Stormare had at the opening.
Mm-hmm.
So I like that it's, even though we're not told what this is, you can make some assumptions, but I also like that they again reinforce that you cannot conduct company grounds because that's important for the end of the movie. And also the markers are a new thing, but we don't have like actual literal contracts signed in blood. So this is kind of a cool underground equivalency. So again, I think these movies are very good at giving you what you need to know without over explaining, because there's a lot of new stuff they throw at you in this one.
So much
with how this whole not even underworld, because an underworld implies it's not a whole lot of people. That's what it's like, half the planet, as we find out. And he also tells him, like, yeah, you gave him a marker to a guy like that. What the hell did you think was going to happen?
Not only do we get that world building, we get the connection, but everything is done in shorthand that is easily understandable. We don't need a different movie would explain that mark. Five different people would explain that marker, what it means, how it works, the ritual, the blood. It's not there. It's, they open it up. You see there's two spots, thumbprint for one, thumbprint for the other, and blood. We get everything we need to know about it. Winston checking out some coins here in the box. We get everything so simply. Like, it doesn't, at this point, it does not insult the audience by trying to spoon feed it. It's just like, here you go. We're having some fun. Hope you enjoy the ride. And I think that is a testament to the way that it's being done, because it keeps that flow going. It doesn't stop to baby shit if you don't understand it.
A lesser movie also would have revealed like what Santino did to help him. They still call it the impossible task. It's still murky. You still don't know the full details. And I'm glad that they never feel the need to expand on that.
Wick leaves his dog with Sharon and tells him that the dog still doesn't have a name. He's walking through and gets frisked by Ares, played by Ruby Rose. I had known this girl from the Orange is the New Black. And of course, Adam probably knew her from Resident Evil. She doesn't say much here. In fact, she doesn't say anything. She uses her face a lot. I don't know. She's just kind of here.
She's the weak link, but I've said that basically about everything she's ever done. So I'm not going to say this is a huge step. I appreciate that for a movie that's got minimal dialogue, you have an assassin who's a mute. I think that's a cool touch, but outside of that, there's nothing all that interesting. And this is the problem with some of the casting in this movie. The first one, you had Willem Dafoe, who certainly added a lot of legitimacy and could do some of the heavy lifting that Keanu Reeves is, I don't want to say incapable of, but he's not that type of actor. And you don't really, you have some people like that in this movie that they bring in, but the two like big assassins, you're starting to see the problem of when you cast non-actors to be in these type of supporting roles versus someone like Willem Dafoe, who is as credible as they come.
And she doesn't seem like she belongs at the Continental. Like, what does she do to get to the Continental? Like, I don't know. She just doesn't feel, you're right, she just doesn't fit here.
I always kind of want to like her more than I do, you know, and give her a chance, but she's fine. I mean, she flamed out on screen quicker than Ronda Rousey, you know. I mean, she's just, you know what? I enjoyed half of her Batwoman season. she turned into such a brat about that and so many other things. I used to have goodwill towards Ruby Rose. I don't really anymore. She's fine in this, but I think you could have really made this a cool-ass character. Now I see Ruby Rose. I don't see this assassin, and it's a little distracting.
So he goes to Santino, who says that he didn't want to do this, and he would have respected it if John had just stayed retired. Santino says he needed the boogeyman John Wick, and he wants him to kill his sister Gianna because their father left her a seat at the high table when he died, and she represents Carmora
and Bellera form.
He goes.
You just call them the Italian mafia.
Okay, yeah, there we go. She represents the Italian mafia. He says that she's in Rome, and he needs the ghost John Wick to go take her out. Wick gets his briefcase of things, which includes a suit and some weapons. This suit. Oh, this fucking suit. Ugh.
I love this, though. We are a quarter of the way, exactly right here, we're a quarter of the way into the movie. We just got the what, the why, everything before this is almost like a prelude to it. We get what the rest of this is supposed to be, and now we're off on a new task. Like, the pacing of this is pretty fucking great.
Yeah, and I also like how it's seemingly very straightforward. Just go kill my sister and we're even. It's almost it's intentionally vague. And I also like the, I know you're thinking of killing me and how fast you can do it before my guys shoot you.
He's being watched by Ares as he walks in the Continental of Rome. He's met by Julius, who fails to recall the last time Wick was in Rome. He gives John the key to one of their finest rooms and tells him to enjoy his stay.
This is stunt casting. To get Franco Nero, this is stunt casting.
Exactly. Yeah, I thought the same thing.
I love that he's got just one question. Are you here for the Pope?
Yeah, that was a good laugh. More coins being exchanged, and I love how almost every single person in this movie, and this franchise, quite frankly, has at least one tattoo. Like, you get these old women here, we have these chicks in this room, all of them have tattoos. Wick's shown some weapons and is offered a new suit and is shown a map of D'Antonio Estate. Wick then asks for something robust and something big and bold and, of course, some cutlery. This fucking suit he's given. Oh, God. At one point, he does the Batman. He just kind of holds it over his head. This is when we get into some stupid shit. I don't like this.
I could watch on a day when I just am flipping through YouTube. I will watch the John Wick suit up sequence. And to your point, and I never put it together. Yeah, I guess this is Batman going down there and picking out his weapons and suit. But from the moment that he just asks for the tailor and he's going to go see the sommelier and all that, I fucking love this so much.
Yeah, I am a sucker for suit up montages. And I appreciate that we are... The first one did not eliminate the possibility of getting more outlandish because, you know, we talked about the difference between being heightened versus being grounded. I like that these movies, as they go along, are getting more comic bookish because that's really what they are. These are kind of what I wanted from the Kingsman sequels, where they get more outlandish, but I still feel like there's a sense of reality. Like, I don't feel like it at this point, it's too cartoonish. Bulletproof suits, yeah, it's dumb. But I am a sucker for Batman, and this is also basically the Punisher going to see Mike Rowe to get suited up for massacring a whole buffet table full of people. And I do laugh that they got Peter Safonowitz, because all I see with him is Brian Butterfield, and I can't stop laughing.
But also, it sets up the rules. You know, but this suit alone, we see the rules for how the suit works. The weapons that we see later on. It's a fun sequence to me, but it's still setting up and explaining to us. And it plays fair with what it does. I don't think we get cheats with these guys.
He's also not getting, you know, laser guns or an RPG that's the size of a car. He just gets a shotgun, a rifle, and some handguns. Like, it's tactical, like he says, but it's also stuff that, you know, like Benelli M4s are used by, like, the German SWAT. Like, it's not... The fact that he has access to all this stuff is not ridiculous. And it also goes to show that the benefit of Keanu is you have a guy who's trained, and he looks believable handling all this different equipment.
I never thought about it until this viewing. Like, why would he need to go here and have all this explained and all this? He's been out of the game. And anybody that knows weapons and firearms knows how quick and how things can change. And I appreciate that you have this person here, much like wine, knows every vintage that's here. And by the way, as somebody who the firearm safety, his trigger control and his checking clearing, I appreciate it. And I think it's important when we see weapons in movies that they're not fucking sloppy. I love that somebody takes care to show safety.
This is also good contrast with the gun that he gets from Lawrence Fishburne later on, just showing the contrast between, like, when you have access to basically any manufacturer possible versus a gun that was used in World War II.
Yeah, I definitely thought of Kingsman while watching this, since we just reviewed that earlier this year as he's getting suited up here. It's hard not to. And yeah, you say he's given all these quote-unquote real-like things, but he's also given a bulletproof suit.
Yes, he is.
So
yeah, but also, he's got a bulletproof suit, but shame on the henchmen because they don't aim for the head. Their fault.
He's told to enjoy his party as he leaves and equips up, and we cut to a huge concert slash party slash boy, would I have loved this in my 20s, as Wick makes his way in. Big buildup as the singing continues and Wick continues walking, and Gianna is here. She's greeting everybody. She heads to her meeting with Akoni, who tells her that she can't take what's his. She replies with, "What was yours is now ours," and ends the meeting with telling him to have some fun. So she then heads back to this huge room to take a bath as Wick approaches. I do like this room. I like the production design here. Man, the money's definitely on the screen. We mentioned it last week, but Matt, it's really on screen here, isn't it?
But these guys are so good about how they shoot Wick. It is like Michael Myers showing up behind you in, you know, like Carpenter's Halloween, where he's just there. It adds to him as, like, speaking of Michael Myers, he is the boogeyman because he can just, like, almost apparate into rooms. But I also like that nobody's surprised. They're like, it's like when the Punisher shows up in the comics. Not to keep comparing the two, but when you see the Punisher and you're a criminal, you just pray that he murders you quickly. And that's kind of the same thing with John Wick, where he shows up and the person's like, all right, I'm going to die. Can we just go easy on me?
I love this rave. I love the cinematography, the lighting, everything about this is freaking beautiful. And the score in this, I am not a huge one on rave music, but this, I have downloaded it. I've played it. I used to use it in a podcast. I think this shit is just awesome. And before he gets in there, we see him setting up his route out. And all the weapons that he places on his way in, he gets on the way out. And that is such a genius move that is not necessary, but 100% pays off. And yeah, to your point, him showing up behind Gianna, and my note here is he is her literal boogeyman. It is a brilliant camera shot from the point that it's just slides one way, slides the other way, and he's there. And she knows right off the bat exactly what happens, and I love it.
I like how he's treated as the Grim Reaper coming to take your soul.
Yeah, it's inevitable. She knows.
Grim Reaper.
And she's like, whatever you do, just don't monologue, because I know you're not a good enough actor to pull it off.
Gianna says that there was a time they could be construed as friends, and she asks what brought him back. He replies with a marker held by her brother, and she asks if the marker is how he got out, as well as the name of the woman whose life was lost that brought him here. He responds with his wife's name of Helen, and Gianna asks if her death was worth the life he's living now. Interesting game of chess being played here, right, Adam?
It is. This scene, I mean, there just seems to be such a depth of history, and we don't have to know what that is. We just know that it exists. I also love, much like we discussed in No Time to Die, though I wish it was done a little better here, she's not this young, like, pinup model, which is what you would traditionally get in this kind of movie. She's a woman of age and power and beauty that is just, it shines through.
Yeah, she's really good in this. I don't know what else this actress has been in, but she's fantastic in this scene.
And she gets naked without a shred of vanity.
Exactly. And to me, it's something about the way, you know, Keanu's got this reputation, but I think it's shown here.
She says that Santino will take her seat and Wick will have been the one who gifted it to him. She then takes off her robe and does the job herself because she lives her life her way, so she's leaving it her way as she asks if he fears damnation. This blood in the water spreading from her body, this is some Elizabeth Bathory shit going on here.
Also, this is a movie that understands the joke that House of Cards made in its first season, where if you're going to slit your wrists, you do along the track.
Yeah, they do. They definitely do it the right way. Although, he shoots her in the head, so they're not going to see that her wrists are slit.
He still did it. He still had to do his job, or he would not be free of the marker.
He then heads to the party as he's called out by Cassian, who is Gianna's bodyguard, played by Common, who asks if John's working, and he replies that he is working. Again, very matter-of-factly, before they pull up their guns and shoot at one another. We're seeing more gung-fu here as Wick makes his way through the crowd. This stuff with him and Common throughout this movie is probably my favorite part of this movie. This is good stuff.
Man, why couldn't you give him freaking John Stewart Green Lantern years ago? It's surprising how well he fits into this world, yeah. Does a good job. Common is kind of underrated, and I love that it's just so matter of fact. Like, you working? Yep. He knows what John's here for. There's no doubt about it. This is fantastic. Everything about this is just, God, it is so clean. I love it.
And he also knows that whatever he's here to do, it's already happened.
Yep.
It's done. Yep.
I was surprised how much I liked Common, because I kind of winced when I saw that casting. Because he showed up in Suicide Squad, and I was like, why are you here?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look, I know a lot of musicians and actors try to branch out, and I will give him credit. It looks like he put in the work with the fight choreography. Certainly didn't look like he half-assed it. You know, he's got a physicality to him. I mean, he'd been making movies for a while. A lot of them crap, though. Like, he did Smoke and Aces. He was in Terminator Salvation. The one thing I liked him in was, I don't remember the name of the movie. It was Liam Neeson and Joel Kinnaman, where Ed Harris sends Common to go kill them. I don't remember what it was called, but I liked him in that. So I feel like if you use him correctly and don't make him your star, I think he could be pretty effective.
Yeah, third time he's played an assassin, too. So this action scene is bigger in scope than the club scene from last week, but I'll say I like that one slightly more. I just think this is more of the same that we've seen before.
No, I understand that thought, and I love the scene last week. But I think because of the way that this is choreographed so well and shot, and it's just a dance of violence. Even every time he gets hit, you know, you see him covering up with that suit, as ridiculous as it is that it could take all that damage. I think it's all thought out. I love what they did last week. To me, this takes that, pluses it enough that I should like it less, but I do like it more.
Yeah, I'm very much in Adam's camp, where I should be, I don't want to say annoyed, but I should feel like I'm living through Groundhog Day, and they're just trying to go bigger for the sake of going bigger. But I feel like you have to, given the context, if you just murdered someone who was basically on the, I don't know, the Knights of the Round Table of the Underworld. So it makes sense that there would be this almost armada coming after him. And we need to see him, now that he's back, the muscle memory has come back fully thanks to that first movie. So we're getting to see, maybe he's a little bit older and slower, but this is the guy all those stories were about. And you need to reinforce that and show it. And watching him just splatter these people left and right. But it's also not, there's a lot of blood squibs. And they do look practical. Like, some of them, I can tell it's that, like, fake CGI blood.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the close-up shots when he just blasts them with the shotgun. I also love that he shoots a guy three times with a shotgun. To the point where he puts the gun on the guy's head. And just pulls the trigger. Like, he has, like, the boogeyman, because he has, like, no conscience. It's almost like a light switch flips when he goes into, like, kill mode.
I guess I'm just not over all the goddamn catacombs that we went through in our last retrospective. But I'm just kind of tuning out here.
I will say, it does feel like a video game level. You know, as I'm watching it, I'm like, man, this is a video game, like, through and through. But I don't know. I think I'm really into this shooting style, camera shooting style.
Wick finds Ares, and they exchange pleasantries, kind of, before unloading some shots at one another. And this scene is fucking dark. It's only lit by gunshots, so I don't know. I guess this is one time when the lighting just kind of got to me.
Well, I appreciate that they're not using the dance floor and all, like, the flashing lights of that to highlight this, because you would have, like, had epileptic seizures from that.
Wick is again hit by a car, this time driven by Cassian, and they get in a little game of cat and mouse before fighting one another. They're fighting through the streets before crashing right to the Rome Continental. I do like this. Like, Wick just kind of sticks his hand out. It's like, you can't touch me, and they're reprimanded for it.
Yeah, I touch base.
Yes. It's then recommended that they visit the bar to calm themselves, so they're having a drink together. Adam, I think you and I have had nights like this. We fight, but once we drink, we're okay.
Let's have a drink. Let's settle down.
Exactly.
Although you can tell he's a psychopath because he drinks gin straight.
Cool.
Like, I'm sorry, that shit is made for cocktails and nothing else. Not like bourbon where you have tastings and that kind of stuff.
Cassian says he'll make it quick, and Wick says that he appreciates that. He'll try and do the same. Cassian then says that this round's on him. Consider it a professional courtesy. I love the relationship between these two. I love that they're fighting and now they're here just having a drink. This is fun.
Well, I also like that this is kind of he's the Dafoe of the movie.
Yeah.
Where these guys do have a history.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I don't want to kill you, but I'm paid to do a job. Like, there is such a thing as, this is a world where money talks, mm-hmm. not so much consciences. There's no hitmen with hearts of gold, which I kind of appreciate.
Very much so. I mean, it's much like Dafoe last film. I mean, this started because he killed his ward. You literally took away his job. He lost. So yep. He's got to do what he's got to do at that point. I don't think it's any type of vengeance towards John. It's just, this is part of my job after you killed my protectee.
So Ares is communicating through sign language, which makes it hard for someone doing a plot summary to this fucking movie. She asks him if she can buy him a drink, and he turns it down. Santino then calls and pleads his case as John hangs up.
I like that that's a direct reference to the first movie where he hangs up on Vigo.
Yes. He then calls the Continental Desks and tells them that he'll be checking out in the morning. He starts packing some plastic bags with his stuff as a contract is put on Wick's head for $7 million. Wick checks out as the price on his head is processed and the calls ring in.
I love how they have the freaking like IRS setter.
I know.
For hitmen contracts. Like, where do they get all these people to work?
I say the one thing too, like the entire now last third of this film, because this is when it flips. John fulfilled his marker. He did that. That's it. He never should have refused it. The reason he was there was because of him. Now, goddamn, Santonio, don't care. It's what D'Antonio. Fuck. He said, now I have to avenge my sister. Like, you just flipped it. You absolutely flipped it. He was righteous in what he did. He put the mark on himself this time.
If I wasn't doing the plot summaries, I'd do the exact same thing, Adam. I'd be calling him Santonio as well. Ares tells Santino sorry that she fucked up. We're hearing that Wick completed the task as the marker is over, but Santino says that Wick is going to be dead soon anyway. Winston says that he stabbed the devil in the back, thinking that it would stop him, but now that he's free of the marker, he can do whatever he wants. Winston,
now, go ahead. I don't like reprising characters, but if there was ever a moment for Ian McShane to reprise his Deadwood legacy of saying cocksucker, it would have been to this guy.
Winston goes on to say that Wick came back for love and says that he did warn him as he walks off. Meanwhile, Wick is being attacked from all angles, including by this huge Yokozuna-looking sumo guy. But this is when we see Wick actually stab a guy with a pencil. Now, this was... Did we have to see this? We heard the story, so we have to see him stab a guy with a pencil. And he not only does it once, he does it twice in this fucking movie. I groaned at this.
Jerzel does. Before this starts, though, before he leaves and does it, when this speech is being done explaining that, there is a statue. And I was trying to look up to see what statue it was, because the camera pans up while Ian McShane is doing the speech on it. And depending on the number of arms, and I couldn't count because of how it was turned, it is either Shiva or Vishnu. And both of those are absolute destruction and vengeance gods. And that is such a little piece that makes no sense, but is brilliant to fucking put in right before Wick goes on his terror spree.
Yeah, that's when it gets into some highfalutin shit, though. And they also do the whole reflection of the soul later in this film. Way too many fucking religious allegories in this. So Wick runs into Cassian once again, and they're shooting at one another through this fountain, which was fun stuff. They go to the train station as Wick is attacked again, and Cassian approaches. Very Matrix-like here with the train.
Oh, yeah. I was thinking of the third. Oh, yeah. I was thinking of the third one. I think there are references. I mean,
definitely.
There's a blatant one coming up. But mm-hmm. I also appreciate that John Wick does not discriminate against women. Because that violinist, he breaks her neck like she was anybody else. Like she was anybody else.
They go on the train and just stare at one another as people gradually start leaving the train. Cassian pulls a knife and stabs him with it, all in front of passengers. Some more hand-to-hand combat happens, and Wick ends up stabbing him. He tells him that the knife is in the aorta, and if he pulls it out, he will die. Wick then tells him to consider it a professional courtesy.
So this is also a nice way to say if we ever want to bring him back, exactly. We sort of have an out.
Mm-hmm. I see him coming back, just finding a way to snap off that. The blade is permanently affixed.
Adam, these scenes must drive you crazy just looking at this, considering you drive a fucking train.
Yeah, don't call the train operator, please. Just let it fucking go to the end of the line so he can get off and take his well-earned break or lunch or go home. Okay, operator wants to get to the end of the line. Leave him alone.
And also, New York subway tunnels are not that clean.
Exactly. I thought of that too.
I was like, clearly this takes place in an alternate reality. Like a guy running through New York, webbing across buildings is more realistic than these pristine subway tunnels to go through Grand Central Station.
Cops show up as Wick is walking around beat to shit. And he finds a homeless man and gets hidden by blankets until the guy shoots the cops. This was fun stuff. I like this.
Yeah, the homeless guy who's like Batman, where yeah. makes people disappear.
Yes. He then walks out to, okay, the role that Lawrence Fishburne called and begged for. Look, we've established on the show, even earlier in the year when we did Mission Impossible, I like Lawrence Fishburne, but this role is just silly. He's so over the top. I did like seeing him and Reeves reunited in this, but him just going, John Wick, it's like, oh God, way too much of the Bowery in this.
The meta part notwithstanding, has, you know, the difference is Keanu Reeves looks the same.
Yeah,
compared to Lawrence Fishburne. Like you go back and watch that first Matrix. I'm like, yeah, he's aged pretty well. Lawrence Fishburne, not so much. Mm-hmm. I enjoy his presence. I like that the two of them have a history. It's sort of the reverse Neo Morpheus, where it's like, I don't like you, but I will tolerate you because you're good at what you do. And I do like that even the guy who, he's almost like Fagin from Oliver Twist, where he's got like all of his pickpockets helping him out. He looks charitable, but he's not. I think he's a welcome presence, but he's also kind of the comic relief that the movie needs at this point, because it's been considerably more dour than the first one and certainly more brutal. I don't mind someone who's more theatrical, because I got tired of Lawrence Fishburne being Mr. Serious and everything. And this works for me in a way that his campy turn in Predators did not.
Oh boy. Yeah, maybe we'll get back to that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like his purpose in this movie. I really do. I just don't like the way Fishburne's playing it in this.
I like 90% of it. 90% of the time, 90% of what he says, I'm for it. And that's enough that I'm just like, it's a welcome break. This thing has been redlining it all the way till here. We need to let the engine cool down a little bit before we go to the end. So I think this is I think it's well done, but I do understand your point. You know, it is meta like a son of bitch, but realize this movie series, this is for the generation below us. This is their Matrix.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't seen The Matrix, so it is very meta for us, which is funny because that's what Matrix 4 is about, is just fucking being meta, but it's a welcome fun, and I kind of enjoy seeing him just, after so much of, to Matt's point, Lawrence Fishburne being dour and serious and fucking everything from, you know, whether it was the DC universe to whatever the hell he did in Predators, I like this one.
Oh, that's right. He was fucking Perry White, too. God, I forgot that.
Perry White, and then he was in one of the Ant-Man movies and never has been referenced again.
Fuck,
that's right. He was Goliath. Yep.
Oh, I haven't seen it since it was out.
Lucky.
I also like that he's like the opposite of Kingpin, where instead of being high society, he's like in the slums, but he still has this major like crime syndicate.
The Bowery tells Wick that he's not good at retiring. Yeah, no shit. And he says that he knows Wick is there because of Santino's price on his head. And Wick says that he needs Bowery's help moving him underground. Wick says that he knows Bowery will do it because he knows Wick is the only one who can help him. Matt, is this what you're referencing when he says you have a choice?
There is no spoon. There is no spoon.
Yes. Red or blue
that
pill.
Too, yeah.
Wick tells Bowery that Santino has Gianna's seat, though he wants the city. Wick then says that if he kills Santino, he knows that they'll come after him. And then Bowery ends the conversation by saying, "You owe me." And Wick replies, "Trust me, you don't want me owing you," which was kind of funny, actually.
So that's a good line, and it also is good characterization for John, because you have to ask the question now. He got his revenge. He's on the run. Does he just have a death wish and he's going to keep going until he runs out of gas at this point? Because he's got nothing. So I think it's the ultimate paradigm. How do you kill someone who has nothing left to lose?
So Wick goes and gets attacked again in the classy setting, and Santino says that Wick is there. More gunfights, and he stumbles down some stairs. There's some good stuff here. I do like these fights.
What I love about this is, one, I always appreciate magazine management clips for some people, and bullet counts and such. He gives him 7 bullets, 7 rounds. Those 7 are gone in about 2 seconds, and then he has to take the weapons off of everybody else. And he does, like, the first person he shoots, like, 5 into one, and then 2 into another one, and then he's got to take their own firearms to use back at him. This fucking just great.
7 million, seven bullets, yeah.
But that's also, if you know the M1911, it only holds seven rounds. Like, that's accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Watch Captain America, the First Avenger. He kills a lot of people with that gun before he picks up the shield.
Wick finds himself in a room of mirrors and bright lights as Santino says that he doesn't get it. The marker is complete, and he should have just run away. He then says he's not Old Testament. Jesus Christ. And
literally.
Killing Santino won't stop the contract. It'll just make it worse. He then says he thinks Wick is addicted to vengeance and that vengeance is all he has. Wick is attacked again and he says that you wanted me back. Well, I'm back here again. He then jumps through a mirror and attacks as Santino and Ares. They get ready to pounce. Big hand-to-hand combat scene with Ares where he even breaks her arm over his leg. Ouch. And sets her down.
Oh, there is no chivalry when it comes to a death match.
No. She then tells Wick that, be seeing you, and he replies with, sure. We cut to Santino going to the Continental to see Winston, who says his evening looks like it's been colorful.
I love how smart-assy he is.
Me too. Very snarky.
Because he's also like very like, oh, technically he didn't break any rules.
Yeah. Santino wants Wick's membership reprimanded, but Winston says that he hasn't done anything wrong and this kingdom is his and his alone. Winston also tells Santino to enjoy his kingdom's privileges. Wick then comes to see the manager and Sharon says that he's waiting for him in the lounge. And then we get the steak scene from The Matrix, apparently, as they're sitting here eating steak. No,
I was thinking this is a very smart reference to another action movie. This is literally Lethal Weapon 2 and Diplomatic Immunity.
Oh my God. Didn't make that connection.
Because that's the card he pulls. He's like, I'm on sacred ground. And he knows, like, if I kill him, that there will be, like, legitimate consequences. So he's trying to use the diplomatic immunity excuse. And technically, his membership gets revoked.
Mm-hmm.
So Murtaugh's line also rings true here.
The tension being ratcheted up the second John walks in the door is crazy. Because we know what'll happen. We saw it last week with Perkins. So we know the ramifications of what will occur to you if you commit violence, if you work on continental grounds. On the flip side, I think we all know that John Wick is not just going to turn heel and walk out, you know? And I love that even Winston, the look on his face, you know, so glad they got a great actor. Even Sharon, he knows what Wick is here to do. And the face acting that we get is fantastic. And then Winston just being like, John, walk away.
Yep. Winston tells Wick to walk away from Santino, but he doesn't. He just shoots him dead, to which Winston asks, what have you done? And Wick responds with, finished it. Sharon says that the dog was a good dog. He enjoyed his company as Wick grabs the leash and says, let's go home. Wick gets in the car with the dog and Sharon says it has been a pleasure before shaking Wick's hand and saying goodbye. Wick then goes to Winston, who says that Wick's contract has now been doubled and gone international, and Wick is now excommunicado. He says Wick's life is now on forfeit, and Wick is not dead because Winston deemed it not to be. He tells Wick he can delay the contract an hour and gives him a marker for down the road.
Before he gets to this park here at the very, very end, I love that he goes home. He goes home with doggy, whatever. And to me, I think he knows his life is forfeit, and I think he goes home to die. And then we literally see the ferryman with Sharon, with Lance, you know, Reddick showing up as the man that takes you to the other side. And I think he's prepared for that, and he's willing to welcome that as an ending until he's given a chance.
I hate that he's given a chance, though, because Winston, he gives him an hour. He shouldn't give him an hour. He should just kill him dead right then because he broke the fucking Continental rules. I thought that was the name of the game. They're just fucking with the rules here, and I hate it.
Man. Well, Winston's putting his neck out too, as we'll find out. So he's doing this even though he knows there will be consequences for himself. That's why I buy it. Like, I buy the two of them having a genuine friendship, where he's like, I'm helping you as much as I can, but you're on your own.
But I'm not talking down the road. I'm talking for this movie. For this movie, I'm pissed. Wick says, tell them that whoever comes, whoever it is, I'll kill them, and I'll kill them all. Winston says, of course you will. He calls him Jonathan as Wick walks away. The contract is confirmed as excommunicado as Wick is walking, beat up, passing by everyone in a paranoid state, and he runs with the dog. The music picks up, and the wheels are put in motion for the sequel. And that's when credits roll on John Wick Chapter 2. How do we feel about the final scene here?
I mean, definitely makes you want to see the next one immediately. Even though we weren't sure if there was going to be a third one, that wasn't a given. So I like that they kind of, they're setting up the Running Man in a lot of ways. But you know what would have made me laugh is if you see, you know, all everyone's turning on their phones, if one of them is Hugo Weaving.
Oh, shit.
Oh, I would have laughed my ass off.
No, you wouldn't have. You would have said that's too many callbacks. That is bullshit.
No,
we heard all that in Mission Impossible.
No, because I miss Hugo. Where has he been?
Great question. I think he's doing
voice. I don't know. Do they have him in that Ring series?
Oh, he's too good for that bullshit.
It's a little hokey, I will admit. You know, having everybody be a part of this world, it's a little much. Do I have fun with it? Yes. But it is an eye-rolling thing, but I eye-roll with a smile because I have so much fun at the same time. I'll say, though, the sun goes down really fucking fast.
Yeah. Yeah, that was my
because I feel note. Like he's, yeah. I feel like he's high noon, and then he leaves the park, and then I feel like it's like 6 p.m. in New York in the building.
So oh, yeah, like, it's like X-Men 3 when Magneto moves the bridge and suddenly it's nighttime. It's
exactly like that.
I just hate that we're setting up another movie. Last week we felt so contained. This week it's all fucking set up, and I'm left pissed when I leave this.
But I still feel like I got a cohesive movie because the movie is all about two things: rules and consequences, and he broke both of them.
Yeah, well, nothing gets solved. So that
no, he kills Santino. He closed that book.
Okay. Scale of 1 to 10. What do we give John Wick Chapter 2? Adam?
This was one I can still remember it clear as day watching this movie because this takes what John Wick did. It puts it through a little bit of a different filter. It's a little more stylized. It's a little more colorful. The music hits a little harder and with just a bigger thump. And this is, I think, one of those sequels that changes the direction of a franchise, capitalizes on it, and whether or not it does it better is open to personal interpretation, but I think this shows what a sequel could be and should be. It expands the lore, it brings in some new characters, it develops our main character a little bit, but he's not changed. We see more, we want more, and this thing, it starts with foot on the gas, literally, at the beginning of this thing, and rarely, if ever, lets up. I could not believe how kinetic this thing was. And I've seen it a number of times, but it's been a few years now, not since before the last one came out. And God, I fucking love this movie. I really do. Understanding that at the beginning, it's John's fault. John put himself in that situation, and then as soon as he gets himself out of it, he's put right back in it. The rules haven't changed, they're just enforced, and I kind of fucking love that. I think this thing is shot beautifully. I think Stahelski really deserves a lot of credit for this thing being a two-hour music video that is gorgeous to look at, amazing to watch, and fun to watch by yourself or with friends. I love this. Gosh, man, this one was hard to score because I don't see a lot wrong with this film. This is one, if it's put on in front of me, I'm not going to move. I'm going to do it. I'm going to give it a 9. I thought I might give it the same score as last week, but I think I actually like this a little more. It's a different kind of film, but fuck, I love John Wick too. 9 out of 10.
Wow. 9 out of 10. Matt?
So I was as anticipatory towards this as I could have been for a movie that was not tied to an existing property. And I'm glad that I not only had my expectations met, because I hate being disappointed, and I feel like that's all we've talked about lately with modern movies to a certain extent, but this was everything I wanted it to be. I got a new take on a character that I've grown to, I don't want to say love, but I enjoy watching him work, but I wouldn't want to be in his way. And it's a good example of how to take your sequel in a new direction and make it bigger without blowing your load on special effects and globetrotting, all that kind of stuff. Not that there isn't any, because they go to Rome. I like that you're seeing different continentals. Like, everything's not just New York. Like, it's not like Marvel where everything just takes place in New York in the comics. But I am going to say it's better than the second one. I'll say I'll like it more. I like it more than the first one, barely. So that was also something I was not expecting. So I'm going to give this an 8.1 just because I have to say I like it a little bit more. I can't quite go a 9 because there is a certain amount of, I see Garrett's points with the ending, But also that kind of reminds me of chapters in a book. You end on something that literally makes you want to turn the page, but you know, you got to put the book down and wait 2 years. So I kind of like, it's so rare I'm left wanting more in movies. Sometimes I feel like I get too much, and sometimes I feel like not enough. So it was nice to leave this high table hungry for dessert. And I give this a very enthusiastic 8.1 on 10. Love it. I think it's one of the better sequels, certainly action movie-wise, in a very long time.
Wow. An 8.1 and a 9. Well, I guess I'm going to be this guy then.
Here comes the 4.
We haven't had a podcast like this in a while where I completely disagree with both of your summarizations, but I do. I will say this. I think the opening scene and the stuff with Reeves and Common are great. But I think this movie's a step down from last week. It's not only one step down, it's two steps down for me. I find a lot of the action scenes here rehashes of what we saw last week. Yeah, they're more stylish, they're better to look at, but they add nothing to build the character that I liked so much last week. And they have all this highfalutin religious allegory bullshit going on that they are so full of themselves when they go on and on and on with this shit. And the final scene was bullshit. I left angry. At this, I was like, you know, I want to see the third one because I kind of have to, because at that point, well, we were leading up to the third one, but I'm not looking forward to it. This is a 6 for me. There's some good action. I do like the stuff with Gianna and Wick. I think that's good stuff. But man, I was not happy when I left it originally, and I was not happy when I watched it for this podcast. I was just like, you know, this is going. Please let it end. Oh no, that's right. That's how this ends. So, yeah, 6 out of 10 for me for John Wick Chapter 2. 2 points down from last week. But will next week be a step up? I sure as hell hope so, because I don't want to be this guy this entire series. Last week, I enjoyed. This week, I enjoyed to an extent. Next week, we have Chapter 3, Parabellum. They had a word to it. Matt, what are you expecting when we just talk about John Wick Chapter 3 next week?
My thought was when I sat down and I saw the preview, I'm like, gee, if the Avengers called John Wick, it wouldn't have taken them 5 years to undo all that reality nonsense in Endgame 3 weeks prior. I was so excited for this. Couldn't be more anticipated if I tried. Because I feel like they've raised the bar, and it's, like I said, an original property that I staunchly support, and you're 2 movies in, and I vastly enjoyed both of them. But third movies are a challenge, especially in action movies. I mean, boys, we've talked about Lethal Weapon 3.
Alien 3.
We've talked about what?
Alien 3.
Yeah, but Aliens is an action movie. The first one's not. There was the debate about Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I will say the trailer for the third one, I staunchly remember that scene of him on the horse. And I sat there going, okay, is this going too far? And some of the casting, like when I saw Halle Berry, I kind of rolled my eyes. I'm not going to lie about that. So I was excited. I mean, if you're going to establish or set up that everyone is out to get him, then he better leave body count the likes of which we have not seen in a movie. Like, he needs to kill more people in this third one than, like, Jason Voorhees does in all the Friday movies combined, if you're going to tease me with that conceit. This needs to be, like, all of the Rambo movies combined.
He definitely has a Jason feel. You guys talked about the boogeyman aspect of him in this. I definitely felt that. Adam, what do you think we're going to get when we talk about John Wick Chapter 3 next week?
Boy, I was excited. You know, I had watched these two because I had heard so much about it. And this was an opening night, I think a Thursday night. I watched it. I went from work to the theater, IMAX, because I could not wait. Went by myself. Laura hadn't seen any of them at that time. But based on the way that 2 ended, which little hokey, but it, to me, that walked right into what part 3 was going to be. And after watching 1 at home, watching 2 at home, there was no way I wasn't going to see this in a theater. And my anticipation was pretty fucking sky high. There was a lot in 2019, but boy, it was sky high for this one.
Believe it or not, I was kind of excited too. Just seeing him on that horse, I was like, wow, how are they going to pull that off? And how much of Halle's work are we going to review on this? I mean, we did Kingsman earlier this year, but she will be back being reviewed next week. So until next week, when we talk about John Wick Chapter 3 Parabellum podcast. Without them, we live with the animals. Thank you, boys.
So, you want to kill him? You want to kill him? I want to kill him. What about you, Mr. Vic?
I'm going to kill you.
Oh, for better, of course, yeah. But it looks like we have ourselves a genuine conundrum.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Just have fun, Albert.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
What have you done? Finished it.
Check out the Percolated Media archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including the Planet of the Apes franchise, Star Wars,
the ongoing Marvel series, Lethal Weapon series, the Alien franchise,
the Mad Max movies, Avatar,
Mission Impossible film series,
Jurassic Park, and so many more.
A man can stay here a long time and never eat the same meal twice.
Good day to you both.
Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett and Matt.
Well, sometimes you gotta cut a motherfucker.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
I have enjoyed his company.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
Consider this a professional courtesy.
Scheduling done by Matt.
He's coming again.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Jonathan, just walk away.
Yeah, Jonathan, walk away.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is an independently produced podcast, and it's thanks to the support of listeners like you that help keep it that way. Please like and subscribe, as well as leave a review on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
John Wick is a man of focus.
This podcast is a Percolated Media production. Copyright 2025, and any and all sound and audio clips are used for entertainment purposes only.
He's excommunicado.
Unless you wish to become the same, I suggest you lower your guard.
We gotta go. Ah! Now.
Matt, it's inevitable. It's time for a sequel, right? Matt?
Sorry, my mute button was okay, stuck. I hope that's not a harbinger of things to come.
I thought it fell asleep, like you did earlier. Okay, go ahead.
Well, a lot of people want me to shut up, so it's nothing new. It's a bit of a surprise.
You know, I personally have been watching a lot of old Japanese samurai films and things like Kurosawa, Snowblood, things like that lately. And I use original audio and subtitles. Partway through, I stop looking at the subtitles and I don't need it. And I think that this is kind of in that vein. And for somebody like Keanu Reeves, who loves that era of film, I think it's intentional.
It's funny you mention that, because I feel like you would like John Woo's Silent Night movie, because that's basically the whole premise of the movie. Joel Kinnaman doesn't talk.
He can't talk. Yeah, his throat's shot out. It's, yeah, that's a fun ride.
I've heard about that and forgot about it. I'm making myself a note.
Yeah.
It's stupid, but I mean, look, it's a lot better than Mission Impossible 2.
Yeah, generally liked it. She dug it. So
yeah, but she likes you.
That's true. So
we need to do that as a retrospective, like Christmas action movies, because you had that. You had the one, what was the one with David Harbour playing Santa?
Oh, not Bad Santa. What the fuck was the name of that?
The one he just did. The one they just did.
We watch it every year, and I can't think of the name of it.
Yeah.
Is it Violent Night?
Violent Night, yeah. Because Fat Man is Gibson, right?
Gibson, yeah. Okay. And we could throw in Krampus, do like all bad Christmas movies.
Just no Bad Santa. I hate that movie.
Yeah, that movie sucks. So Wick
Ram... Do you think that was bad? Try sitting through the second one. The second one is unwatchable.
I'm good. Ugh. So Wick rams another